This is the Auntie Anne Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie Anne Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast. Hi, Andy.
Hello.
Thank you very much that you're going to share your story with us. And also, we talk about your charity endeavours you've done.
Yeah, sure. Hi, Claire and everyone. So about 6 years ago now, in early 2017, I was in my early 50s and I was experiencing quite a few symptoms, which at the time I was putting down to getting older. So feeling more tired, the memory not as good as it was. Then I started to limp, and occasionally when I was walking, my foot would slap the floor a bit as well. I kept bumping into things, and when I was driving, I can say this now because I don't drive anymore, I was occasionally clipping things or clipping curbs and hedges on the left-hand side of the car. At one point, I was driving home. This was about 3 or 4 months before I was diagnosed, and I ended up outside the wrong house. So I drove back. It was close to mine, but I drove back, parked, looked up, and it wasn't my home. So I thought, oh, hang on. Oh, was I getting dementia? All these things going through my mind, all while holding down quite a senior job, not having any time off sick, because I was finding ways to cope and ways to manage. Then I went to the doctor 2 or 3 times for the different, like for the headaches, for the limp and other things. And it was, like rheumatoid arthritis or early onset this or what have you. And then, unfortunately, I'd driven to work 40 miles and back, and then I came home with an absolutely spitting headache, wincingly pained. And when I got home, I started to throw up as well. So not in a good way. Mm. It was January the 12th, 2017. So it was just after Christmas. So I was like, I've eaten too much. What's going on? And then, so I thought, what should I do? Woke up in the morning, and I couldn't really move my left arm or leg very well. So that was scary, and I couldn't speak either. I was thinking what to say, and I couldn't speak. So my wife called our local GP, who came straight out, and he basically said, call an ambulance. I think he thought I was having a stroke. So down to A&E, blue lighted. I don't remember too much about it. And then in A&E, they did a couple of checks, and about 5 or 6 hours after getting in there, the doctor came and said, you've got a large cranial mass. Mm. And we said that because my wife was with me. He said, what's that? He said, it's probably a brain tumour, but we can't be certain. So that was a shock to the system, because up till that point, I ought to have an idea about brain tumours, about having one, certainly, or even what they were. So my initial thought was, how long have I got? Mm. But then he said, this is in front of my wife as well, and my kid was there. She was a teenager. And he said, we think by the look of it, it might be a meningioma, he said. So it's a tough card of hands, but if you're going to be dealt one, that's the one you want to get. Mm. I'm like, what? What does that mean? Stayed in a few days. They did an MRI, and then they came back and said, yeah, we think it's a meningioma. They didn't know at the time whether it was benign or malignant. Mm. So they did. That was pretty much it. Then off you go, home you go thing. So I was then home for about 7 weeks while they decided what to do. They had to have a multidisciplinary team meetings and all those good things. And that's 6-7 weeks later, I went in for surgery.
Where they sent you home for 7 weeks, were you still then having symptoms, or had they given you something to help during that 7 weeks? Did they give you, I don't know, maybe they gave you steroids or something?
No, it's a good question. They did put me on steroids.
Okay.
So what they explained is, and when I went in first, the first thing they did was put a steroid intravenous drip on to get it in quick. And that took all the symptoms away. Because what they were saying is that the actual symptoms, it was it was a large meningioma, 7 centimetres, would you believe? So it was about the size of an apple, which my daughter always said I only had half a brain, and she claims that proves it. I said there's built-in redundancy. But anyway, I don't know. And they said it could have been growing for 10, 15 years at least.
Yeah.
So once, and what was pushing, what pushed the symptoms over the edge was swelling around the tumour, because it was starting to displace the brain and push it down the spinal cord column. And the centre line of my brain, I forget what it's called, was pushed out of the way. They said it was very close to closing the blood supply into parts of the brain. And the technical term I got from the Macmillan nurse was, it was close to knocking me off my perch.
It's a good way of putting it.
Because I was on steroids, the symptoms disappeared. So they said, so they put me on quite high dose of steroids, which then they wanted to decrease gradually over the... And at the time I went home, I didn't know how long it was going to be until surgery. They said it's going to have to be surgery because it's so big, it's got to come out. The only silver lining I had was there was no choice. I didn't have to agonize over whether to have surgery or chemotherapy or radiotherapy. It's got to come out. Okay. But that was quite surreal because I was home for about 6-7 weeks then. I actually felt physically fantastic because steroids make you feel good. So all my little aches and pains went away and I thought, oh, this is quite nice.
Yeah. Did you put weight on with the steroids?
I did, yeah. You feel hungry all the time.
Yeah.
So I was having to try and discipline myself, but you do. And my face looked, if I can say this, looked like it had been blown up by a football pump at the end of the 6 weeks. It was very round. At the time then, you don't really care about these sorts of things because it was keeping the symptoms at bay. And I didn't feel too bad other than I didn't sleep. So it's quite a surreal existence. It was just bizarre.
How did you calm yourself? You've got that 7 week wait. I would have felt like that was just forever. Did you have any support during that time to help with the weight?
No. The treatment I got in terms of the tumor was great, but in terms of support, virtually nothing. So I had, the only support I got really was from the Macmillan nurse who'd come round in the hospital and I was in just for the weekend after being initially diagnosed. She came round and she was an absolute revelation. She's the first person I spoke to that used terms I could understand. Because they kept talking to me in hospital with these big long words and I'm thinking, I've just come in with a brain injury and a brain trauma and you're explaining stuff to me. I don't get it.
Yeah, with 10 syllables.
Oh, just a bit, yeah. And every day someone else come in and say, you've got X, Y, Z. I'm like, what I was actually having to do is just after the doctor's round in the morning, I'd text my wife and say, this is what they've just told me. So at least I've got a record of it. But anyway, so I did call the Macmillan nurse a couple of times. But other than that, nothing really. They just said, well, go home. You're on steroids. That'll keep the symptoms at bay while we decide what to do. And it's funny because I never really felt... in like I was going to die, if that makes sense. Part of me was almost relieved because, and it seems strange to say you get a brain tumor diagnosis and you're relieved, but I'd up to that point thought I was either having early onset dementia because I was going to the wrong house, or I was having a stroke because I couldn't move my arms. So at least I knew what I was dealing with, and that calmed me a bit.
Yeah.
And then talking to the Macmillan nurse. And, oh, the best thing as well was, she pointed out, the support groups. So two of the charities, Brain Tumor Charity and Brains Trust, have got online Facebook closed support groups.
Did they direct you to that, or did you go and find that out yourself?
It was the Macmillan nurse did, yeah. The actual medical staff in the hospital didn't. I didn't get much from the hospital staff, but the Macmillan nurse who, again, just I was happy, lucky to be in a hospital that she was based at with an office. And she said, oh, have you tried these Facebook groups? Because looking through other people's stories from there that have had similar experiences, just reading through those and asking questions, and everyone's open. That's how I got information about what was happening and what was likely to happen. And that calmed my nerves down because they said, you're on a production line. The people doing the surgery do it day in, day out. They know what they're doing. Yes, there's risks involved. However, just think of yourselves as you're the next on the line and then off you go. And that calmed me down. So during that 6-7 weeks, while it was a surreal existence, I didn't get too anxious, if that's the right word.
Yeah.
I don't know whether steroids does that, whether it makes you feel slightly euphoric, I don't know. But it certainly didn't. And even on the morning of the surgery, because I'm quite squeamish, I'd never been to hospital before. Other than seeing my kids being born. I was squeamish, so I was fully expecting to be absolutely terrified. But even on the morning of the surgery, I wanted it to happen because I knew it had to happen. Let's just get this out and what will be. And my daughter, bless her, she said the best thing. She said, it's all right for you, Dad, because you'll be asleep. And if you don't wake up, you'll never know. It's us that have to deal with the consequences.
It's true, though, isn't it? It's like you're asleep dreaming and they're panicking and worried for the next 10 hours or whatever.
Exactly, yes. It's much harder for the families. And that kind of made me feel, stop feeling sorry for yourself almost and think about the families. So, who were absolutely fantastic, by the way, helping me. That was a big source of help as well, just having the family, my wife and my kids there, just almost like treating me like normal, and just being there. So that if they were sometimes and it was tearful. And I said to my wife when I was in hospital just after being diagnosed, I said, can you bring a pen and paper and I want to write the kids the letters in case I don't survive. She said, I'm not doing that. Yeah, she said, I'm not doing that because you are going to survive. And I went, okay, you're the boss.
Once you woke up and you were a bit more coherent and the drugs have worn off a little bit, did you have anything you were struggling with?
I count myself very lucky because I didn't really have anything afterwards. I woke up and my surgery was midday through to about 6 or 7 o'clock. And I can't remember the specific time I woke up, but I remember thinking, oh, I can move my... Because my wife was told just as I was going down, oh, by the way, he might not be able to walk when he comes out. Okay. So I was feeling my fingers, feeling my toes. Yeah, everything works okay. I can feel myself. I could remember things, which is the most important thing for me as a person that I could remember going back over the years. So I felt, yeah, I've got this. Didn't have a headache once, which is amazing, given what they did to the head. You have a very tight, white... I used to call it a turban, but it's on to sort of compression
bandage,
to keep
yeah.
the, which bent my glasses, which annoyed me. But that was, I think, come on, don't be annoyed about that.
Did your scar rub where your glasses are? I'm only asking this because
no,
I had a problem with that.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, my scar and my hair's grown back over it, so you can't actually see it now. Mm. So it's.
I found that I couldn't wear my glasses, so I was blind as a bat.
Oh,
and you're lying back, aren't you? Because you can't actually, I don't know if you had the same, did you have a drain?
Yeah,
so you can't quite sit up, can you? And
thankfully I didn't. I didn't have anything when I woke up.
Mm.
There's literally, had the white tip and had the glasses on, but the scar didn't get, you know, it wasn't sore at all.
Yep.
It was fine.
I suppose the drugs, though, that they're giving you is everything's numbed out.
Yeah, I was still pretty dosed up, to be fair. So, yeah. The one thing I did do, though, which I was quite pleased, was we'd joked a bit with my kids, because I'm one for humour in these sorts of situations. We've joked when people go into the hospital and in a coma, you sometimes hear that they can talk a different language when they wake up.
Yeah, that's true.
So I joked with the kids, I bet I could speak Mandarin when I wake up. I don't know why Mandarin ran. So I got back up to the ward and 2 hours after getting back up to the ward, I thought, I can text now. I feel okay to text. The first text I sent was a load of Mandarin random, and I sent it to my kids. It was gobbledygook, mind you, but they thought, since after that, they've said that was the best text they've ever had, because it not only was I alive, but it also proved I still had my sense of humour. So within a couple of hours of my surgery, I was texting people. I didn't have any headaches. I was still on steroids. No symptoms afterwards at all, other than the tiredness. But no, I think I'm very lucky in that respect.
How long were you in hospital for? When could you go home?
Oh, that was interesting. Yeah, because my surgery was on the Thursday, February the 16th. And I went home on the Saturday, which I'm like, what?
Wow.
I had surgery on Thursday. Friday, they're just checking. And too much information, but they had to wait until I'd used my bowels effectively to make sure I could. Once I'd done that, they said, no, you can go home now. And I'm like, well, hang on, I've just had major brain surgery and 2 days later you're sending me home. And they said, there's nothing much you could do in hospital. So I went back. I remember walking out of Southampton with my scar, because half my hair was shaved away, because they only shave away the hair they need to. And I had a white sort of plaster over my scar, and I must have looked horrendous. But no, I went home and they said, that's it now. So went home 2 days afterwards, which I still think is amazing, to be honest, in a good way.
Yeah. After you get told, we'll be in touch with an appointment, did you get told what to do next? I found that no one gave a map.
No, you're absolutely right. And I didn't have a clinical nurse specialist either. So I had no one from the hospital I could really ask. I had the Macmillan nurse who I asked, but no, effectively they said, right, off you go. And we'll see you. You'll have a meeting with us again in, I think it was about 10 days time, with the neurosurgeon. And after that's it. I had no contact at all from the hospital. I had to have my staples removed.
Yeah.
So I went to my local GP to have my staples removed. And about a week after that, went back to the neurosurgeon team in Southampton. And they basically said, we think we've got it all out. Off you go, basically. And that was it. So thankfully, I was in the Facebook groups online.
Yeah,
so I can ask, what do people do next? There's no guidance.
No, and they've told you that we feel we've got everything out. In 2022, you then found out that you still had some and you had to have some radiotherapy. Were you really shocked when you found out about that?
Yes, absolutely. You have annual MRIs after surgery, or I did anyway, just to check no regrowth. I'd had three of those, fine, They said, we'll go through every 2 years now, wait 2 years. On that MRI, which is the beginning of last year, so that was 5 years after my surgery, they detected some regrowth. I wasn't told at the time anything about regrowth. I wasn't told to expect it. I was told that you'll have your annual MRIs. That's just to check everything's okay. I'd even got my, it pains me to say it now, I'd got my I've been clear 5 years, whoop-de-woo post ready. Mm. And then we get the sort of results, and there's a small regrowth. It's about the size of a grape, so just over a centimetre. And I'm like, it came as an absolute shock to both of us. It was like, oh, fancy that. Okay, so what do we do next? And I was with a different team then, because I was with the radiotherapy team in Southampton again. And they said, come in and talk to us. And they said, because it's small, relatively well-bounded, we think it's appropriate that you have stereotactic radiotherapy. And of course, I look at my wife and go, what's that? And they said, it was like gamma knife, is another term for it. So it's very targeted radiation to take out the regrowth. Now, the regrowth was in, it was right on the edge of where the original tumor was. So they think it was maybe a few cells, if it's not been taken out, that had laid dormant for 3 years and then decided to grow. Mm. For they don't know why. And I'll probably never know, because with radiotherapy, they don't actually go into your brain, so they don't take anything out. So they're using experience and guesswork. But yeah, I had the gamma knife radiotherapy beginning March last year.
How does gamma knife work?
People of a certain age remember the original Ghostbusters film. Ghostbusters. And they basically say, don't cross the beams of the various, I don't know if you remember that from the Ghostbusters film.
So is that with the marshmallow?
That's the one, yes. When they're all firing their separate beams and they say, don't cross the beams. In radiotherapy, you cross the beams. Mm. So what it is, there are two sources of radiotherapy which on their own don't harm healthy cells. But when they're crossed, they superimpose on each other, and that radiation will then kill off the cells that are in the area where they're crossed. Mm. So the reason for doing it is because it's only harming the cells in the specific area where the beams cross. So it's not harming the rest of the brain effectively or anything else. Yeah. So what they do is they take a very detailed MRI, and that lasted about 35 minutes, to get an absolute very detailed idea of where the tumour is, the regrowth. Then you go in and have the mask fitted, which is a plastic mask. So they lay it over your face when it's warm and press it into your face for about half an hour. So there's holes in the plastic, but it's very tight in, and they're even pushing it into your eye and pushing it around your head. And then what happens then is that basically then sets, which is what half an hour is. That mask is then clamped to the table, so your head cannot move. And they take another CT scan to work out where your head is in relation to the mask. And then they overlay that with the detailed MRI, so they know exactly where your brain tumor is in relation to the mask. Mm. So that with about a week later, you go in for the actual radiotherapy itself. And sadly, you put the mask back on, they clamp it to the table again, which again is really unpleasant. And then I was lucky again, it was only 35 minutes. So they had about five or six pulses, which lasted about 2 or 3 minutes. Then they'd move the table around a little bit, or move the what was generating the radiotherapy beams around a little bit, do another couple of minutes. And so the whole thing lasted about 35 minutes.
Did they offer you like a tablet to relax you? Because I think they don't there. They can give you something if you're really anxious.
I forget what it's called now.
Did you have that?
It's just a fairly common. No, I didn't. It's one of those, I hate having MRIs and I hate having that, but I've personally developed ways of coping. Mm. In the MRI itself, which I still don't like, and I've had countless of them, when I'm having the MRI, I find out how long it's going to last, because I normally have about 3 or 4, which lasts about 5 minutes, and then I count backwards to try and count the seconds down to when it finishes. Another one I do is count backwards in 3 from 1,000. Or the other one I've got is an A to Z. So I like an A to Z of Star Wars characters, or A to Z of dogs, or something like that. And I find personally, if I distract my brain, I'm okay. If I lie there, the first MRI I had, I was lying there thinking, I'm trapped, I can't get out, this is over my foot. Oh my. And I almost had a panic attack. But once I'd realised, no, don't be silly, just right, A to Z of Star Wars characters, right, okay, you go through that, and by the time you get halfway through, your brain, my brain anyway, is distracted. So I've been able to cope, and I think there's an element of you just, whether it's a male thing, you think, just roll your sleeves up, mate, and get on with it, because you've got to have the MRI, you've got to have the mask fitted, you've got to have the gamma knife, so just get on with it. But that's, so those techniques I use personally, and they, so far, they've proven fine. What I would say is that from the surgery I had 6 years ago or so, it took me about 4 months to get back to work part-time and about 8 months to get back to work full-time, which I did, which I was proud of. With the gamma knife, I felt fatigued for about 10 days. After that, it was absolutely fine. If anyone ever said to me, would you like surgery or gamma knife or even radiotherapy, I think, yes, please, radiotherapy, because it's so much easier to, in my case anyway, to recover from.
Yeah.
In fact, I was worried about, because I didn't feel a thing. I'm thinking, did they have the machine switched on? was Windows working, the sort of thing? And then, but about a week after, a part of my hair about the size of my palm fell out over where they were treating the regrowth. So at least I knew the thing was switched on. You lose your hair over where it...
Has it
grew back. Yeah, it grew back within... It fell out, literally. I was in the bath one day and all... Oh, okay. Within about a month, it had grown back again. Mm. So I don't know whether I've got particularly resilient follicles, but I'm lucky it was just temporary.
Yeah. So after you're feeling a lot better than you were expecting to feel, was it then that you decided, I want to help other people?
Yeah, so I had the surgery in the February of 2017. I then retired at the end of 2019. So I got back to work, took, like I said, about 9-10 months, and I worked for about 2 years, but it was too hard. The fatigue was too much. It was, my work-life balance was atrocious, because I could just about work, but one of the symptoms and side effects of any brain injury, including brain tumours, is you get fatigue. It's just really horrible tiredness. So I retired at the end of 2019, just before COVID hit. And part of the reason I retired was because I wanted to, physically it was tough working, and I was lucky enough to be able to retire. But I thought, I want to volunteer for one of the charities so I can help others in the way I was helped. So I picked Brain Tumour Charity, contacted them, and I became a volunteer. And what I did was actually, I became an administrator for the Facebook groups. So for a couple of years, I was one of the people, there was a team, one of the people that when someone applied to go into the groups, you have to do a quick sanity check to make sure that they're legitimate, if that makes sense. Because you do get some horrible people that try and get in the groups to sell stuff. So I was working from home, and they trusted me enough that I was actually administrating the groups.
Did you
that really helped me out.
It's very busy to do a Facebook group with such a big charity. Did you find you had to plan your timing? Because it's tiring. There's people coming in all the time and you're having to look all the time.
It's a good question. What the charity were very good at was saying, only do as much as you can. So pick the hours you can do, because anything you do is a bonus. So they had a sort of a core team that were doing it. But then the more people that volunteered, the more the work or the load got spread out. So what worked for me was I did 2 or 3 hours 2 days a week, and usually on the Tuesdays and the Thursdays. And that helped me because it gave me a bit of routine. Because when you retire after 30 plus years, you get, all of a sudden your whole life has been routine. Now you've got no routine. It's quite a big change. So that gave me a bit of routine.
Yeah. Tell us about the volunteer award.
As you mentioned it, and I didn't bring it up, I'm honest. So
I can't think, we can't talk without mentioning that.
Glad you said that. Yeah, so as well as doing the Facebook group, and they were saying, could you do more? I said, yeah, I could do more. The charity then set up, just over 2 years ago, a more semi-permanent team of volunteers, and they called them Involvement Champions. This is the Brain Tumour Charity. So they called them Involvement Champions, and it was a two-year cycle that came to an end last June, I think it was. And that allowed us to get more involved in the charity. So I was doing the Facebook groups. As I got further away from my surgery, my symptoms did decrease, and I found I had more capacity. So I was able to do more things with the charity through being an Involvement Champion. So last year they updated their strategy. So it's a seven-year strategy to 2030. So I was involved in working groups, chaired a couple of meetings, all those sorts of things. I started getting involved reviewing some of the website information, went in and did a couple of talks to the charity. I became a co-chair of the charity's podcast, which I was never on the plan, but I did one and I thought, quite enjoy that. So I chair. So I, every sort of month, the charity puts out a podcast so people can go and see those, mainly around specific topics like managing headaches or what's radiotherapy or what's gamma knife, in fact. So I got involved doing that. And then I was getting involved quite a lot. And then went and saw a couple of companies on behalf of the charity. So I was doing a lot of these things, had an online meeting with an MP, which is quite interesting as well. And through all of that, last April, they had their annual awards and I was awarded the Volunteer of the Year for the charity, which was, for me, it was a massive accolade because I don't volunteer for awards. You volunteer because you want to help people.
Yeah, it's nice to be acknowledged.
However, it was in a way, again, the charity are very good at thanking you. I've got about 10 thank you cards and what have you. But it was, I don't know what the right word is. It was acknowledgement that I was making a difference. And that meant a lot to me. I was on the British Neuro-Oncology Society, had a panel session the week before last with a load of experts plus me as to give the sort of the patient voice. So I'm still involved with the charity, but yeah, so that was quite neat. And then if I could mention my other award.
Yes, it's quite nice to think that there are awards to have if you're helping in a charity.
They're called third sector. So these are the charity awards for across all of UK charities. And these are like the Oscars for the charities. Mm. And I was shortlisted for Volunteer of the Year in that. So that was almost like getting in Oscar speak, like getting a best actor nomination. Yeah. So that in itself was good. I didn't win, this is back in September, but I got a highly commended award, which they didn't hand out to too many people. That to me almost meant more than the Brain Tumor Charity one, because that was charities up and down the length of Britain. And think about how many people volunteer for charities. And to be recognised in that meant that people outside of the brain tumour community realised what a difference we were making as a charity and what I was making as well. So that was, again, a pleasant surprise, but that was quite a nice... I also helped Radiotherapy UK.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that.
Because I had radiotherapy or a form of radiotherapy, I got in contact with Radiotherapy UK. I've been, for the last 6 months, been part of a patient engagement group. So there are, I think there were six of us with different types of, that have had different types of radiotherapy. So there was someone there with breast cancer, colon cancer, cervical cancer, and so on and so forth. And I was representing the brain tumour community. And we've been helping Radiotherapy UK, giving them a patient voice for some of the things that they're doing. And they invited me up to the Houses of Parliament last week because there was a, I think they call it the Lancet oncology plan. So this is a, because the government haven't, don't want to get politics, but because the government haven't issued their 10-year cancer plan, a lot of the charities have got together and proposed something equivalent, which they were effectively unveiling last week in the House of Parliament, hoping that some of the, or one or more of the parties might pick it up and put it in their manifesto for the next election. So that was quite an, and Tim Fallon, the MP, was the chair of the meeting. So that was an eye-opener as well. So that was interesting. So it's anything I can do really to help out these charities with the patient voice, because I'm lucky enough that I can still function, dare I say it, okay, then I can still contribute without having too much of a toll.
But not too much pressure as well. You're doing it at your time when you're feeling you can do that.
Absolutely. So I can manage it. And that's one of I find that's one of the keys to managing fatigue, is to plan your activities. Again, I'm lucky because I'm retired. But if I'm doing something quite heavy like that, the next day I will make sure I'm not doing anything. And I used to feel guilty on those days, thinking I should be doing something and I'm doing nothing. But then what I do now is I call them recovery days. Mm-hmm. And the recovery days you need either before or after doing something busy to help you function when you are busy.
Yeah, so, I find though with some of those kind of things that you're doing, you find that there's no such thing as a 5-day week. It's like you actually end up with a 7-day week. It's very easy for a brain tumour patient to overdo it and feel guilty if you're not doing stuff, but we have to sometimes take it into consideration that we're slightly broken and we have to pay attention to our body sometimes.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a learning process and I'm still learning. Over 6 years after my surgery, I'm still learning how to manage to manage that. What I would say is it's with the charities, it sounds a lot, but they do allow you to pick and choose. So I find it comes in waves. So there are sometimes there'll be a 2 or 3 week period when I'm doing very little, and then all of a sudden I'm doing 2 or 3 things back to back. I would thoroughly recommend volunteering if people have the ability to do it. And I know these are tough times and people can't work for free and what have you, but if you get the chance to do any sort of volunteering, the amount of benefit you get to your own sense of well-being almost through helping others when you're doing it because you're choosing to rather than because you have to,
is
phenomenal. It really is. It's been a revelation, to be honest. So you're right, there are times when it's really hard work, but because it feels like I'm helping someone else, it doesn't feel hard work, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
but you're right, I have to lend to my I've got a spreadsheet body. Which I monitor. I monitor what I do. So it's things that are really tiring, I make a note of it. And I've noticed if I do too many things that are tiring too close together, I get really fatigued and then it just wipes me out. Mm. The only way for me anyway to fix it is sleep. Mm. Managing what I do and my activities has become more and more important.
I think it helps to volunteer within a place that understands your problems that you have. It makes it a lot easier to feel less guilty because they understand, and we are all in the same situation where so many of us get fatigued so easily, and that we have to manage our days because otherwise we will just burn out. Everyone can burn out, but we just have a little bit more.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I completely agree with that. And it's I think that's why I do volunteer for the different charities, but they're all within the brain tumor community, because you're absolutely right. They understand.
Is there anything that you would like to say thank you or acknowledge or anything like that?
Definitely my wife, Jane. She's been so understanding. You know, I'm getting emotional now. It is. No, she's been an absolute rock. She's absolutely amazing. Day in, day out, she's there for me. She's helping me. I could not do what I do without her, to be honest. My children, I've got 3 of them, they're in their 20s now. They've been really understanding, but also they keep me on my toes. You know, my daughter, bless her, when I say, she'll say, "How are you feeling, Dad?" And I'll go, "Oh, I'm feeling a bit tired." And she's, "Oh, it's always all about you, isn't it?" And things like that, which is actually quite, they share my sense of humor. It just, again, just amazing. You think, no, actually, I shouldn't be feeling too sorry for myself, but they're fantastic.
If people who are listening and want to now go and get involved in some charity, what would they do?
Yeah, I think all the main brain tumour ones. So you've got the Brain Tumour Charity, Brain Tumour Research, Brains Trust. I'm probably forgetting. Those are the main ones. They've got, if you go onto their website, and I know the Brain Tumour Charity and Brains Trust certainly have, there's actually a section or like an online form you can fill in to apply to be a volunteer, and it shows you where you can get involved and the sorts of things you can get involved in on a volunteering point of view. So go on the website, do a search for volunteer, and it'll take you to where you can actually apply to become a volunteer.
Have you got to know people that are doing the charities volunteering as well? Have you made like some really good friends, and is there like a nice community?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. The involvement champion, there's about 15 of us. We're still on a WhatsApp group. I still talk to a few of them quite regularly. I don't use the term friends for life because it sounds like I've just come off Big Brother or Love Island, but they probably are friends for life. Not that I watch those, of course.
You said you did watch Love Island. I heard that bit.
Do you know I do? To answer the question, yeah. There are people, and also people who work. I won't name them because it's a bit embarrassing, but there are. For the Brain Tumour Charity, there's about 3 people that I know really well, and I'd stay in contact with them even if it wasn't a volunteer. And the same, I'm quite close to people in the Brains Trust, and I think I would stay in contact with them even if it wasn't for doing the volunteering, because they're just nice people. I found people who work in charities tend to be nice people. Mm. I know that sounds that's a stupid thing to say, but in industry you can get and some people who are out for themselves yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah, politics, office, all that. With charities, there doesn't seem to be any of that from what I've seen. It's just full of nice people. That's one of the things I've really learned. If I had my life again, I'd be very tempted to go and work in the charity sector.
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
I'm here to help, and I don't want that to sound pious in any way. I'm just genuinely here to help, because if I can join a few dots up and get a few people doing something that gives them a bit of a reason to put a smile on their face, then that makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you very much.
All right. Cheers. Hey. Bye.
This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast.